I'm Marty Moscowain. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in the late 19th century, the Delaware Bay was known as the oyster capital of the world. That was good for business and good for the bay because of the role that oysters play in the marine ecosystem. The oyster population was nearly destroyed in the last half of the 20th century because of disease, pollution, and over-harvesting. But in the last 20 years or so, oysters have been staging a comeback in the Delaware Bay. The water quality has improved, and scientists are starting to develop disease-resistant strains of oysters, which have helped to create more seafood farmers. Today on Radio Times, we discuss the rise and fall and rise of oysters in the Delaware Bay and why it matters. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Danielle Krieger is a research associate professor in the Department of Biodiversity, Earth, and Environmental Science at Drexel University, currently serves as science director for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. Danielle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Greetings, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Also with us is David Buschek, and he's director of the Haskin Shellfish Research Laboratory at Rutgers University at the New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station. Try to say that five times fast. He's also an associate professor at the university in the Department of Marine and Coastal Sciences. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both here. Danielle, I wonder if you could take us back to, I guess, the 19th century when the Delaware Bay was known as this oyster capital of the world. Just how much was it teeming with oysters?
Well, you can go by accounts of the early settlers, and of course we have some harvest data from the 1800s to really understand the picture of a bay bottom that was virtually covered with oysters in many areas. And these reefs extended for miles and miles, and the water was much clearer. So some of the early settlers, when they would sail up the Delaware Estuary, and the same as in the Chesapeake, there's various accounts that something fell over the side of the ship and they could see it on the bottom. And the bottom was also populated not just with oyster reefs, but with submerged grass beds because there was enough light penetrating the water column. That's not everywhere in the Delaware Estuary, but down in Delaware Bay, that was certainly the case.
And David, I guess things began to change in the 20th century.
They did, and they recognized that there was a lot of over-harvesting going on. They started monitoring the beds a lot more closely. And then in the 1950s, a major disease moved in called MSX. And down at that point in time, the way that they harvested oysters is they fished them from the upper part of the bay, and then the oystermen had leases from the state in the lower part of the bay. They would plant the oysters down there, sort of an extensive farming practice, if you will. And when MSX came in, they lost 95% of the oysters they had planted.
And where did this disease come from? Does anyone know?
It appears to have come from the Pacific. How it got here is a bit of a mystery. At the time, there was research being done where Pacific oysters were being brought over to test how well they could grow. That's one possible source. Another major theory is that at the end of the World War II, they had to move all those troops and the equipment from the Pacific Theater back to the East Coast. And literally, they had ships that were welded together in the bays up and down the Atlantic coast, and all the organisms that had attached to them, including oysters, and what was in their ballast water came over with them, and that's another theory about where it came from.
So where is MSX today? Is it gone? Is it in the shadows?
No, MSX is still there today. It's up and down the coast. Rutgers began in 1962. Hal Haskin, who our lab is named after, began breeding oysters for resistance to it. And we now have a highly resistant strain of oysters that is used for oyster aquaculture up and down the East Coast. In Delaware Bay, the population there has, through natural selection, responded very well and developed a pretty good level of resistance itself. That's not true in other bays, but it is true in Delaware Bay.
Let me go back to you, Danielle, and this is something we were talking about before going on the air, having to do with climate change and sea level rise, which we know is measurable, certainly when it comes to the East Coast and probably the Delaware Bay as well. What's been that impact on oysters?
Well, that's a good question. We are only beginning to really get a handle on that, but through some hindcasting and forecasting, we've been able to document that the salinity, the salt content of the water over the productive oyster beds in the middle part of the Delaware Estuary, that salt content has actually increased, and of course temperature has increased over the last 50 years. And projections are for that to increase even more fast into the future. Because these diseases that Dave is talking about, not just MSX, but the derma that came in the 1970s, they are more virulent and prevalent under warmer, saltier conditions. The actual core productive areas that oysters grow best on are actually moving up bay following that increase in salt content. And so one of the consequences of climate change is that sea level rise will bring greater volumes of seawater, saltier water, from the marine system further up into Delaware Bay, which means that the productive areas where oysters can grow best will continue to follow that salt line. This is for the natural stocks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're farming oysters with diseases, you know, disease-resistant strains, you can somehow, there are ways to adapt to that. But the natural production, the main core 2 billion oysters in Delaware Bay are going to move into a progressively more narrow corridor because the bay narrows as you go north up the axis of the Delaware River Channel. So that's one example where sea level rise brings saltier water. The diseases like that saltier water, so they're more impactful in areas where historically oysters would grow best.
But it's interesting because we are also talking about the comeback of the oyster. So, yes, there are these issues, there are these problems, but nonetheless,
right,
we're seeing a bit of a return.
So there is a return, and probably the last decade or two have seen a resurgence in the popularity of oysters. You see them a lot more on menus, and they're marketed very well, depending on where they came from, what bays they came from, what beds they came from in those bays, what company might have produced them. And we have solutions to these problems that we're working on. One is to produce the disease-resistant oysters, and that's an aquaculture solution. Another is the management strategies that we do where we can adaptively manage around the disease and help increase production and maintain quotas on the harvests of the wild oysters. One of our scientists at our lab, Dr. Shiming Guo, has developed a technology to produce triploid oysters, which is something that's equivalent to, say, a seedless watermelon. If people are familiar with eating seedless watermelons,
sure,
it's, if you could say it this way, a seedless oyster in the sense that it's not reproductive. So it grows faster, it can reach market size before diseases can kill it. So those are ways that we're working towards improving this situation.
I mean, the idea of sort of building a better oyster, I mean, is that sort of bottom line, that's what's at work here?
Exactly, that's what we're trying to do.
And then there are some areas of the bay, excuse me, that we think will be pretty good areas for future oyster production that historically have not been good growing areas. And so some of the tributary mouths and some harder bottom areas in the upper part of the bay. So we're already starting to identify those areas that could be good natural oyster production areas as well as future areas to expand the aquaculture operations so that we can hopefully adapt to some of these changes with the climate. There are some political barriers in the traditional paradigm with many of our management, national and state management agencies, is really to only restore historical conditions.
Like back to the 1890s, for instance?
And then in the state of New Jersey, there is a ban on oyster restoration in closed waters to protect human health. So, you know, we're not sure yet how we're going to navigate around some of these barriers. National funding agencies generally do not fund oyster restoration if it's subject to any harvest. But, you know, at the Delaware Estuary Program, we promote that oyster restoration is good both for economic gain as well as for all the ecological benefits that they provide.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, and so Danielle's talking about restoration of sort of the natural wild population. There's also restoration of the industry and the production of the industry that's going on. And there we tend to talk about revitalization more than restoration. And along that regard, I have to say that the state of New Jersey, the Bureau of Shell Fisheries, even the Army Corps of Engineers has been helping us with monitoring and restoring the wild population to help the industry revitalize itself and become a powerful economic engine like it used to be. the harvests that used to come out of the Delaware Bay were, you know, a million bushels or more a year. We're down below 100,000 a year here now. That's for the wild fishery. The aquaculture industry is growing. We're now producing almost 1.5 million oysters in the aquaculture, which is about a tenth of what the wild fishery is. But both those are growing due to management opportunities we've had, changes in the regulations that that the state agencies and federal agencies have helped us work with. The ban is something to protect human health. That's in closed waters, but there's lots of open waters. And working with the state Bureau of Water Quality Monitoring, with the FDA and their regulators that look at water quality, we're really producing a good product that's healthy. We don't see outbreaks of disease from Delaware Bay. It's just a lot of good progress.
Well, let me go back to you, Daniel, and help us understand how, in a sense, how oysters work. And by that, I mean why they're good for the ecosystem.
Sure. We are really looking at dozens of species of bivalve mollusks that live within the Delaware River Basin, really from the headwaters to the mouth of the ocean. There's dozens of different bivalves, and some are commercially valuable. But all of them are ecologically valuable. And basically, they do several important things that benefit people as well as the ecosystem. And the first that we talk a lot about is their filtration of the water. So every single one of these animals, an adult oyster or a freshwater mussel or many other clams and scallops, they all filter tens of gallons of water per day.
Wow.
This is during
those little things, right?
During the spring to summer to fall, warmer time of the year, when they're really growing fast and filtering water to basically meet their nutritional demands, they're filtering tens of gallons of water per animal. That's like a natural Brita filter. And if you think about, if you needed to filter that water through mechanical means, like with a Brita filter, it's going to cost you a significant amount of money.
Sure.
So they're clearing all those particles from the water column, which is beneficial for benthic or bottom production, plants that need light. The light is impeded by the particles in the water column. But also those particles are algal blooms. They have a lot of nutrients associated with them. Many other types of pollutants are associated with them. So these animals will remove a lot of that material from the water column, and then they metabolize it. They change it into things. You know, obviously oysters are very nutritious and good. It's not like you're eating something that's contaminated.
Right.
As long as those particles are in Delaware Bay. So water filtration services or benefits is something that we talk a lot about. But also, when you're looking at the bottom of the bay or a river with freshwater mussels, beds of mussels, reefs of oysters, collectively, they're like biological hot spots in a sea of mud and sand. And, you know, not to say that other habitats aren't important, but an oyster reef is where all of the fish are hanging out, whether they're trying to escape from predators as refuges or whether they're feeding on those reefs. So the habitat complexity, just like a coral reef, the vertical complexity is very, very beneficial to the ecosystem. And the last thing is...
Well, hold on to that thought, only because they're playing my song, and we have to take a very short break, and I do want to pick up on that. That's Danielle Krieger from Drexel University. Also with us, David Buschek from Rutgers University. We're talking about oysters in the Delaware Bay, and we have a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S., Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
This week in This American Life, a man is recruited by government intelligence. His job? To test the security of banks by trying to rob them. And his handler tells him,
do not stay in a bank for longer than 5 minutes. And if you get arrested, stay silent. We'll have you out within 24 hours.
So, he gets arrested. And then, he learns his handler doesn't actually work for the government. This week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. Inishnua Theater Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting the American premiere of Blink by English playwright Phil Porter, directed by Tom Ring, October 7th through October 29th at the Off-Broad Street Theater, 1636 Sansom Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us. tellthestory.us.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about Delaware Bay Oysters. They are staging a comeback. Let me quickly reintroduce the two guests that we've been talking to here in our Philadelphia studio. Daniel Krieger is a research associate professor in the Department of Biodiversity, Earth, and Environmental Science at Drexel University. Currently serves as science director for the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. David Buschek is director of the Haskin Shellfish Research Laboratory at Rutgers University. He's also an associate professor at Rutgers in the Department of Marine and Coastal Sciences. Any questions or comments that you might have for us, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Joining us now is Brian Harmon, and he's the Aquaculture Husbandry Manager at Atlantic Capes Fisheries. And Brian Harmon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So what have you been doing this morning?
Running around trying to get orders together. We've got a nor'easter coming too, so we're trying to get any loose gear that's out in the yard here strapped down and make sure we don't lose anything in the wind.
Can you describe your yard for us?
Sure. Well, basically with any oyster farming operation, there's a lot of gear that's involved. Our method, which is the rack and bag method, we use plastic oyster bags, which are like a 3-foot, really heavy-duty plastic mesh bag. And at any point in time, there's oysters in these bags out in the bay, and there's also bags that are back at our facility that are being dried to dry up the biofouling organisms off the outside of the bag, so that when we do use the bags, you know, there's better water flow through the bag. So basically, that's what's in our yard right now that we're trying to lock down.
And how has business been? I've been talking with our two guests in here about the rise, the fall, and now the rise of the oyster business. Has business been good for you?
Business has been very good, yeah. Everybody's really interested in our product. We grow a Cape May salt oyster, which, like I said, our method is the rack and bag method. So we grow intertidally on a tidal flat that's exposed. The bay bottom is actually exposed at low tide, so this twice daily exposure to the air kind of conditions the oysters to have a really tightly closing shell, which actually prolongs their shelf life. Mm-hmm. And another good feature of that method is the constant pounding of the surf and the waves in the bay kind of agitates the oysters and produces a more uniform shape to the oysters just from the constant movement.
And uniform shape, I guess, in business terms, that's probably a good thing.
It is, yeah. Chefs are really looking for something that is consistent in size, shell shape. They want a nice deep cup on the oyster. They don't want anything that's, you know, thin like a pancake, and when you shuck it, there's not any meat in there. So,
looks like, David, so, you wanted to add something.
So,
go ahead.
So wild oysters, when they're harvested, they all grow together, and the shape of the oyster is determined on how they're overgrowing into each other, and so they'll be all different shapes. And what Brian's producing down there is a nice uniform teardrop shape. When they shuck it and put it on the plate and it comes out, everything looks very organized and orderly and neat. And that's what he's describing. It's a very nice product.
Brian, how long have you been an oyster farmer?
Well, I started with the company here. It's been about 4 years now. Before that, I actually worked for Rutgers at the Cape Shore Laboratory working in the hatchery there, spawning oysters and rearing oyster larvae. So that's really where our product starts, is at these hatcheries. Oysters are selectively bred for nice, pretty shape, fast growth, disease resistance, and then they're spawned, and those larvae are sold to commercial operations like Cape May Salts. And, you know, from there, they go all the way to market.
When we say farmer, you know, we think, at least us landlubbers here, you know, we think of getting up at the crack of dawn and all the kind of physical labor that goes into farming. Same for oyster farmers?
You know, it really is pretty much the same. I mean, there's an element of risk involved. Obviously, we are planning what they call oyster seed, which is just, you know, juvenile oysters. And there's just an intense amount of labor involved throughout the whole process. It's roughly 2 years to market size for us in our growing area. So within that 2 years, these oysters are probably sorted 3 to 4 times just to keep the size consistent within the bag. So the oysters actually grow better if they're with oysters of the same size. So it is pretty much just like farming on land. You're just farming the sea.
And is there an off season for you?
There's a slower season with, you know, this time of year, the water's going to start cooling down. Growth is going to start slowing down. The oysters really don't grow during the winter. The water cools down to the point where they pretty much just go dormant for the winter. Now, that means there's less work on the farm regarding sorting and splitting of the oysters. But, you know, there's really always something to be done. There's a lot of maintenance that time of year, so...
And I guess we have to say goodbye to you, but I guess you're keeping your eye on this impending storm, yes?
Yeah, we're hoping we can get out there bright and early tomorrow around 6 a.m. So I know we're going to be packing the rain gear, but we'll get it done.
Well, Brian Harmon, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. He's Aquaculture Husbandry Manager at Atlantic Capes Fisheries. I'm having a hard time with some of these words this morning. We are talking about oysters in the Delaware Bay and continuing our conversation with Daniel Krieger and David Buschek. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Brian mentioned storms, and I know that Irene back in 2011, I don't know about Sandy, I know there was a big storm, Lee. All these storms have had an impact on oysters.
Right.
So
in 2011, we had actually a really wet year. If you look at the rainfall that came down the Delaware River and the Schuylkill River, salinities had already been low, and they typically fall in the spring, and that really helps the oysters out because it pushes these disease levels down, and how far it pushes them down determines how bad the diseases are going to be at the end of the summer when salinity increases. So salinity had been down, and then Irene came in and dropped the salinity down during when it should have been at its highest point. And the oysters would have done just fine with that. But then Lee came about 2 weeks later and pushed it down further to where over the oyster beds, it was literally fresh water. The Cape May Ferry has a monitor on it, and normally the salinity there would be 30 parts per thousand. I'm not sure if that means anything to you, but it dropped it down to 10 at the mouth of the bay, which is a
because
huge,
there was just so much
there
water.
There was just so much fresh water coming out of the river. And so we're just getting ready to publish a study, the colleague of mine, Daphne Monroe, on what happened here. And it turns out that the salinity dropped below about 7 parts per thousand for a period of 21 days. And at that point, the oysters started to die. They couldn't close up and withstand it any longer. And on the upper part of the beds, where approximately 34% of the stock exists, 70% of those oysters died. And that's a major oyster seed. Brian described seed. One way you get seed is to get it from the wild population. Right. The other way is to produce it in hatcheries. That's a major seed-producing area. So they took a big hit, and the quota fell the following year. Now, Sandy came in and pushed the salinity back up the bay. And that really didn't have a huge impact on the oysters in terms of survival. It brought the disease levels back a little bit. But the big impact of Sandy was on the infrastructure at the docks where they land their oysters and those sorts of things. And so now there's a lot of risk to places where they actually bring their boats in and can land their oysters, and they're having trouble maintaining those facilities.
I wonder, too, Daniel, whether we should think of oysters as that kind of canary in the coal mine. You know, it's the animal that is telling us, be careful, watch out.
Yeah.
Should we think of oysters that way?
Yes, I think worldwide oysters and mussels have been used for as canaries in the coal mine for 50 years or something called the International Mussel Watch Program. So for water quality and that sort of thing. Now with climate change and particularly this new signal with increasing storm intensity and frequency, that's a different type of canary. And we're looking at oyster reefs and other shellfish beds as at-risk habitats. One of the things that a lot of people don't understand or know much about is that these habitats they're really, you know, important complexity, and they can actually impart resilience to your coastal landscape. So much like coastal wetlands and dunes in front of the Atlantic coast, oyster reefs that are near shore, and even these oyster farms that are on those intertidal flats, they cut the wave field actually hitting the shore.
Wow.
And so oyster reefs are protective. And in fact, in New York City, some of the very progressive thinking in terms of armoring Manhattan and other areas is oyster texture, these sort of concepts where you're building oyster reefs partly for, you know, their potential commercial value where the water quality is good, but mainly for the water cleaning benefits that I mentioned earlier, and then the storm protective habitat values.
Well, and do they need to be encouraged to create these reefs, if you know what I mean? I mean, do you need other clamshells? You need other shells that then the oysters glom onto, and then we'll get to our callers.
Sure. It would be really nice if these systems built themselves up on their own like they once would have. But because of various stressors on those habitats, a little helping hand goes a miles and miles in terms of promoting oyster reefs. And so we had a five-year oyster shell planting project in Delaware Bay that was one of the most successful projects. It won a National Coastal America Award a few years back for a successful environmental restoration project that actually returned oysters to production on many of these beds that were planted with shell. And in fact, actually, Baywide, it turned the shell budget positive. So for long periods of time, we've been losing more shell each year from the system than gaining shell, which is very important for long-term sustainability. But that actually made it positive, and I think the numbers were $25 return for every dollar invested in shell planting just from the economic side, and then you're still getting all these extra oysters in the system to promote ecological benefits.
Well, it reminds me of coral reefs. I mean, how coral reefs sort of operate in the same manner.
Unfortunately, the funding for shell planting ended about 2010, right before Hurricane Irene, Tropical Storm Lee, and Sandy came in. So without continued investment in that's, you know, where we are concerned. I mean, there is this resurgence, and certainly the farming and aquaculture end of it will help pick up some of that with a very good product. But for the natural wild stocks that provide all these water quality benefits, they still need our help.
You want anything, David? Then we will get to
it. Right. I just wanted to say that Danielle mentioned a shell budget, and what she's really describing there is you think of an oyster shell as, you know, it's a hard thing. It looks like a rock almost, and it's going to exist forever. They don't. There are critters that bore into them. Things like the acid environment at the sediment level there breaks it down and dissolves it, and processes like ocean acidification, which is a major impact of climate change right now, also acts to increase the rate at which these break down. So they have a half-life of about 10 years, which is the half-life of an oyster. So naturally, they would replace themselves, but we've short-circuited that through a variety of different processes that humans have caused. And so one of the ways to correct that is to plant shells. And the shells that we have a large source of right now are clam shells from the offshore clam industry, which would otherwise go into a landfill. And we don't want to put these things in landfills. They have a good value for the environment, so we want to plant them out on the oyster beds. The problem is the finances to do that.
Well, we are talking about Delaware Bay oysters. They are staging a bit of a comeback and talking again with Danielle Krieger and David Buschek and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And again, we are taking emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me see what Barney from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware has to say. Barney, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I love what you guys are doing with the oysters in the bay. And what you were just talking about, I was wondering, do you guys get subsidies from the government and the state, and how much?
And how much?
And is that going to continue, and, you know, does it ever end?
Well, we are talking about a government shutdown. I don't know if we want to include that in our conversation talking about oysters.
Yeah. So the state of New Jersey does support the management of the Delaware Bay oyster fishery, and there are funds that are provided to do the stock assessment, which helps set the quota. The oystermen themselves have implemented a tax on themselves. So every time they harvest a bushel of oysters, they pay $2 into a fund. And that fund is basically used to help restore the beds that they've harvested on. And this is very progressive. You won't find many fishermen that are going to tax themselves to help keep their fishery active. So that's probably the primary two sources.
But that's self-preservation as well.
That's self-preservation.
Go ahead, Dan.
And then that shell planting project that operated for 5 years, that was actually a federal grant that was operated with Army Corps of Engineers project mm-hmm. funding. That was for an environmental restoration project, but it's not really a subsidy that's maintained over time. It was just a grant to demonstrate that it could work,
right.
And it did work. But we have not been able to get any kind of subsidization of either wild harvests or aquaculture, much like you would have for land-based agriculture or energy sector subsidies. Nothing like that exists, to my knowledge.
Barney, thanks for the call. Let's see what Peg from East Falls has to say. And Peg, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call,
sure.
And I'm really excited about the show. I've got two questions, actually. One is, if the guests know of any research findings that speak to the possible impacts of aquaculture on natural systems regarding bivalves. And my second question is, I know the city of Philadelphia, in various forms, is spending increasing amount of attention anyways and money looking at redeveloping their section of the Delaware Riverfront. Can you think of things that could happen during those redevelopment plans that could aid the recovery of freshwater mussels and oysters and other bivalves in Delaware River? And I'll take my call off the air. Thanks.
All right. Peg, thanks for the call. David, I think you're going to take the last one, yes?
No, I'm going to take the first
you're
one,
take
on,
the first one. Okay.
On aquaculture, the impacts of aquaculture. So aquaculture, bivalve aquaculture, shellfish aquaculture, has a very positive impact on the environment. There are other forms of aquaculture where, for instance, shrimp aquaculture might go in and dig out mangroves, which are very productive habitats, and turn them into a shrimp farm. And that you know, there's positive pros and cons to that. But oysters you're actually recreating the habitat. It might look a little bit different, the rack and bag that Brian described, but there's a structural habitat there that is colonized by other organisms. The oysters are actually filtering the water, which is helping to cleanse the water. So they're creating habitat and they're cleaning the water at the same time. There's no food being added. There's no hormones or anything like that being added to the oysters. It's all a natural product. It's a natural process. It's a very positive impact.
And Danielle, about a minute before a second break, having to do with what could be done, for instance, just a couple blocks from here along the Delaware Bay.
Right.
Delaware
so this
River,
is a new, there's a lot of new ideas that have yet to be proven. But one of the things we're looking at, because in the Wilmington to Trenton part of the system, it's all freshwater tidal. So you're coastal, but you can't grow oysters there because it's too fresh. So we are looking at freshwater mussel beds as part of what we're calling living shorelines. And right now we have a big project that we're hoping to get off the ground in North Camden to demonstrate that you can rebuild freshwater mussel beds along with submerged grasses and fringing wetlands into a habitat mosaic that will provide water cleaning, fish habitat, as well as aesthetics for the urban corridor and potentially flood, you know, abatement and coastal resilience. So we are looking at taking the oyster reef restoration concepts for the ecological benefits up into the urban corridor. Of course, freshwater mussels you would never want to eat.
Okay.
You know,
good to know.
They're not at all like restaurant mussels, which are marine mussels. But for the environmental benefits, there are a lot of upsides to mussel restoration, and not just in the urban corridor, but right on through to the headwaters to the mountains.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Peg, you can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. We're talking about mussels. We're talking about oysters. We're talking about the Delaware Bay with David Buschek and Danielle Krieger. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
Washington sure knows how to get itself into messes, but getting out of them?
Personally, I keep hoping to just sort of wake up and it was all a dream.
Groundhog Day screenwriter Danny Rubin tasked by us to help D.C. make it to the epilogue of this latest fiasco. All the latest on the shutdown in Washington next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Grand in Wilmington supports WHYY and presents comedian Colin Quinn in his one-man show, Unconstitutional, Friday, October 25th at 8 p.m. Quinn tackles 226 years of American constitutional calamities and offers his comedic perspective on our national character. From predator drones to the Kardashians, he pulls no punches in asking if this is what the Founding Fathers planned. For tickets, 837 grand or tickets at thegrand.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, getting an update on oysters in the Delaware Bay with Danielle Krieger from Drexel University, also the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary, David Bushek from Rutgers University, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 and emails at radiotimes@whyy.org. David, we had an email from Chris, actually, from Bucks County, saying a great amount of treated industrial wastewater is discharged into the Delaware River via municipal plants that dot the watershed. Trace chemicals and metals are not removed. They accumulate in sediments. Are oysters tested for pollutants?
So, yes, oysters are tested. Danielle mentioned earlier something called the International Mussel Watch Program, and actually that's a little bit of a misnomer because in some parts of the world they measure oysters, and in fact in our part of the world they measure oysters, and there are several beds that are part of that program in Delaware Bay where they test for contaminant levels of chemical contaminants. The other major contaminant that's tested for are human pathogens that might come out of sewage outfalls. And these are usually coliform assays, but there's also other more specific assays that they do. Our region of the world is one of the most heavily tested areas. They do this proactively. They make sure the waters are certified. Waters are classified as being opened or closed or seasonally restricted. So some parts of the year it may be okay because of the rates of growth of the bacterial contaminants. So the products are tested that way, and then when they go to market, they're tracked with an individual tag so that if there is an outbreak, they can identify exactly what the source waters were, and then they'll respond to that.
You want to add to that?
No, I would just like to say that folks in this area probably don't know that, but there are parts of the United States where different states take different views on this shellfish sanitation safety. There are areas in the Gulf, for instance, where once someone gets sick, they'll go in and try to figure out what it was, and then they might close something down. But here in the Mid-Atlantic, and particularly in Delaware and New Jersey, the states are very proactive with this monitoring program. So, you know, we try to promote Delaware Bay oysters as buying local product that's very healthy for you and that is super super monitored, if you will. So, you know, people should take heart. And we're very careful with our restoration programs to make sure that there's no intersection of restoration that could happen in closed waters, say in Delaware or oyster gardening where private citizens get seed and grow them out. You would never want to eat those if they're in those closed waters. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of education that has to go into it and protection so that we protect the industry and protect human health.
Let me read another email. This is John from Brookhaven. Does dredging on the Delaware River affect oyster population? You're nodding your head there, David.
So, yeah, we actually have a contract with the Army Corps of Engineers to monitor the impacts of dredging activities. And the main... well, there's a couple of different things. One is just the immediate activity would be the sediments that are released into the water while they're dredging could fall on the oyster beds and cover them and cause problems there. Another major impact that's a more longer-term one, which we're going to keep track of in the future, is the deepening of the channel will actually allow salt water to move up. So it's sort of analogous to sea level rise, but instead of the sea level rising and moving up, you're actually deepening the channel and letting water move up that way. And that can bring more predation, more disease, and those sorts of things up the bay.
Go ahead, Danielle.
One of the things we've been looking at the estuary program is that when you combine sea level rise with widening of the bay, with deepening, and with potential changes in the seasonal river runoff because of changing precipitation in the watershed, All of those things combined could make for even more and more salt water coming up when you think of it collectively. So there's been pretty good studies to look at salt rise potential from the Army Corps associated with deepening, but maybe not in association with sea level rise or changing water runoff. And so there's a new study that a researcher at Rutgers, Dale Haidvogel, and a graduate student have been working on to actually project the salinity rise that we should be planning for over the oyster seabeds in the middle part of the estuary, and presented their results at our every two-year conference this past January. It was startling to me that they were basically showing a fourfold greater increase than what previous models showed, and most of that increase was going to happen in the next 50 years, not the latter part of the century. And that's because of the marshes getting overtopped and mostly the increase in volume. But channel deepening, because of this volume issue, is something we are looking at.
But it seems like this is a reason for developing the oyster population, right, to deal with some of these. I mean, obviously they can be at risk because of some of these changes, but also because they have a role to play.
They have an important role to play. And, you know, the sea level has risen and fallen historically over centuries or longer. And oyster populations have actually moved back and forth with that change. The issue is whether or not we've constrained the bay in certain ways through development and other things that will no longer allow that movement to happen.
And there are some other challenges we're looking at. I mean, we do want to protect human health, but many of the future growing areas for oysters are going to be in closed waters. And, for instance, in tributaries and not so much out in the open bay. Also, oysters in Virginia to the south live intertidally. And here, because of periodic winter freeze kill, they're mostly subtidal. But with warming temperatures, we're going to see oysters moving up into our shorelines, which is a good thing ecologically. But, you know, it's going to create some challenges when, you know, we're trying to protect human health in closed waters. So we're going to have to figure out how to thread that needle. We are looking at various solutions with what we're calling oyster management areas that might be gray areas. It's not just black or white, but trying to take advantage of certain opportunities. And we've got some plans on the books, and some of our reports are on our website.
Let me see what Maria from, looks like Tyler's Ford, Pennsylvania, has to say. Maria, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. I just was wondering about the impact of the use of oyster shells in, like, gardening businesses and chickens. I do both of those. I keep chickens, and I'm a professional gardener, and we use oyster shell. And if that has a negative impact on the species, I mean, where do all these come from? And, you know, does that hurt the livelihood of oysters?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. David, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, most of those are going to come from shucking operations, but the volume of them that you're using I don't think are all that significant. I mean, oyster shells are also used in the pharmaceutical industry. They're a good source of calcium for a lot of products. Some of the places where there are larger volumes that are used or used to be used is to, you know, build roadways and things like that, and those are probably less of a. I mean, it's not a bad use of them. I don't want to say that, but it's probably not the best use of them.
Yeah, yeah. I would just like to say that historical practice was that shells were regarded as wastes, and let's do something good with them. But nowadays, with the new scientific information we have about the shell budgets, for instance, in the bay, we are trying to promote some sort of shell recycling programs, trying to figure out ways that we could recollect those shells and get them back out in the bay. And there's been some recent studies that have talked about oyster reefs as the Tums of the estuary. You know, and
like the Tums, like for the stomach
exactly,
antacids.
Exactly, basically to help counteract this ocean acidification issue. It's a huge problem. So they're certainly good to use in your gardens, but if there's no way to get them back to the bay, that's easy. And that's the whole logistical. There's costs involved with moving shells and recollecting shells. And a lot of times people throw trash in with their shells, so you have to separate that. But we do want to figure that out. We do want to promote shells getting back to the bay.
Maria, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Another email, this one from Richard from Delaware. Danielle, what are the disease risks for oysters in closed waters? And there was a question also saying, essentially, if an oyster is what I'm not sure what the word is, but as you said, gallons and gallons of water every day that they're filtering. Does that affect the health of the oyster if someone wants to eat it?
Well, I mean, as Dave pointed out earlier, you have certain types of contaminants like heavy metals or organics like PCBs and so forth that can bioaccumulate in an oyster. And if you ate an oyster that was growing in areas where there's a lot of those contaminants, that would be bad for you.
Right.
But that's why we have these closed water areas. The second class of contaminants, pathogens, well, some of these pathogens, they take up and they accumulate, and then they're basically a delivery vector to you if you eat that oyster. Again, we have closed waters. You are protected if you buy product through licensed channels.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just out with your family and you decide, I want to collect some oysters and eat them, you know, we're really trying to promote education about where that is unsafe. And to be honest with you, many of our coastal areas, you would not want to do that. You know, these animals are taken from open growing waters where there's good flushing with the bay and with the ocean. And so, but from the water quality standpoint, a lot of the particles that they filter out of the water, they're metabolized and changed into things that are not bad for you. And in fact, we're trying to promote the restoration of freshwater mussels and marine mussels that live in salt marshes that are not commercially valuable, because there is evidence that they actually can help decrease the amount of pathogenic particles in the water column because they filter them out so effectively and then they break them down. And that's a good thing.
I have a question. Oh, go ahead, David.
I was just going to add that Danielle said collecting oysters when you're out with your family. Most places, this is not allowed,
right.
And you often need a license, and sometimes it's restricted to a commercial license. So before you collect any shellfish, you might want to check the local laws. Indeed,
or perhaps don't even do it. I mean,
yes.
just to be on the safe side. I had a question about the Clean Water Act, which was passed back in 1970, so more than 40 years ago. David, did that have a positive impact? We've been focusing on the Delaware Bay, but is one of the explanations for the return of the oysters the fact that the Clean Water Act was in effect and helped to clean up the waters?
Well, exactly. And you can talk to anybody who's involved in the shell fisheries business. It behooves them to have clean waters because that expands the areas from where they can grow and harvest oysters from, whether it's a fishery or whether it's aquaculture. And so legislation like the Clean Water Act are actually going to promote that. And you'll get a lot of support for that kind of legislation from the shellfish industry because they want clean waters. It's going to provide them with a product that they can harvest legally, that they can market and provide a safe product to their consumers.
And I'd just like to point out that my organization, the Partnership for the Delaware Oyster as an NEP, is a Clean Water Act organization funded mostly through EPA. So we look at it as a two-way street. On one hand, the Clean Water Act really helped out oysters and other bivalve shellfish. But oysters and bivalve shellfish, when you restore them or enhance their natural populations, mm-hmm. that feeds back positively to clean water because mm-hmm. they're filtering. So it is a really positively reinforcing program if you are working to conserve and to restore, revitalize oysters and other shellfish. And that's something that's a top priority for us right now is shellfish restoration. I do want to, from headwaters to the ocean,
sure.
but I do want to just point out, though, that we do not think that just by rebuilding freshwater mussels in rivers or oysters in the bay that that's going to solve our pollution issues. It all starts with the landscape. We need to continue pursuing the Clean Water Act goals of reducing actual pollutant inputs off the watershed. But restoration of mussels in the rivers can help intercept pollutants before they get to the bay. Restoration of oysters in Delaware Bay and also the Chesapeake, there's a lot of interest in this over there, can help polish the water quality for you. And then you might actually have more of these closed growing areas become open as the water continues to get cleaner.
Because there is this issue of runoff, whether it's urban runoff or agricultural runoff.
Right.
I'm assuming that's always an issue.
Yes.
Let me see what Gerard from Upper Black Eddy has to say. And Gerard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi
Thanks
there.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome.
One of my favorite creatures is the horseshoe crab, and I know it was in decline in the Delaware Bay. And I was wondering if the rise in the population of the oysters and the cleaning that they are doing are having any positive effects on that population. Mm. And I'll take my call, my answer off the air.
Gerard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I have some quizzical looks in here. David, go
ahead.
I'm
not sure that anybody's made a connection between shellfish and the horseshoe crab population. There's a couple of reasons of decline for the horseshoe crab, and probably the largest one is the decline of habitat and where they can nest and those things. But there's...
I would make the indirect connection. There are mutualistic benefits of coastal habitat. So oyster reefs that live just immediately offshore of a lot of these sandy beaches where horseshoe crabs spawn, those oyster reefs help to cut the wave field, like I mentioned earlier, provide resilience, which helps protect the sandy beaches where horseshoe crabs spawn and also the salt marshes that are behind those dunes. Horseshoe crabs also spend a lot of time in these marsh habitats, and Delaware Bay is an especially wetland-rich system with not many beaches. So those beaches are critical habitat for horseshoe crabs, and anything that could preserve and further enhance those spawning beaches for horseshoe crabs is, I think, where the real action is in trying to return the horseshoe crab population around. So oyster reefs in subtidal areas right off of those, and in fact, we're looking at living shoreline ideas that would help protect those dunes and sandy beaches. I think that there's a good indirect relationship.
We're almost out of time here, but David, I began by saying that Delaware Bay was the oyster capital of the world. Does it make sense to try to return to that, or does it just make more sense to say let's do a better job and keep on doing what we're doing?
Well, the oyster capital of the world moved around as the oysters were harvested from one estuary to another, and at one point, New York, if you read The Big Oyster, will lay claim to that title.
Right.
The Chesapeake Bay will lay claim to that title. So it depended on where the major production area was coming from. I think it's that we need to do a better job of producing oysters and maintaining the populations we have.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. David Bush, I thank you very much. And Daniel Krieger, thank you very much as well.
It's been a pleasure.
And we've been talking about oysters in the Delaware Bay. David Bushek from Rutgers University, Daniel Krieger from Drexel University, also the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. And we talked briefly with Brian Harmon from Atlantic Capes Fisheries. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.